There was no doubt a core group of officers at the time who relied on brute force to be able to try to, quote, solve crimes. She said something along the lines of, that looks like him.
Yeah, I'm scared to death. I thought they was going to kill me. They kind of put their hands on me. They choked me, you know what I mean?
Now remember, you know, Marshall was tried in the early 90s. Right? This is before the DNA exonerations. This is before juries really had an understanding that an eyewitness could get up on the stand, particularly an eyewitness who had been so traumatically attacked, and look at a defendant and definitively say, that's the man, but be completely wrong.
You know, I believe in God, I stand strong, and I believe in people. I haven't given up on people. You know, I don't feel no bitterness in my heart. I don't have no animosity, you know what I mean? And I really don't feel nothing against anybody.
She described the man who was about 5'11", Marshall was about 5'7", 5'8", a man who was light-skinned African-American, Marshall is dark-skinned, a man who was about 200 or so pounds, Marshall at the time I think was 140, a man who was in his 30s, Marshall was in his early 20s. Right? I mean, on every indicator it was off.
In 1984, 24-year-old Marshall Hale was convicted of raping a 14-year-old girl in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and sentenced to 23.5 to 47 years in prison, even though the prosecution had biological evidence excluding him as the rapist. Finally, after 33 years in custody for a crime he could not have committed, he was exonerated. This tragic story begins November 11, 1983, when a man with a gun forced a 14-year-old girl walking to school in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, into an abandoned building. He forced her to disrobe and raped her. Before he left, he wiped his genitals with her blouse. The girl was examined at a hospital and a rape kit was prepared. Police collected her clothing, including her underwear, blouse, and knee socks. The early 1980s was a time of transition in Philadelphia. The city's African-American population was growing, and its white working-class population felt threatened. Out of this conflict came Frank Rizzo, who was first police commissioner and then mayor. He had a reputation for violence in the African-American community and even for attacking reporters.
Take that thing out, unhook it, or I'll throw it out in the middle of the goddamn street. You turn that off.
It's on.
It's on. Well, yeah, it won't be on long.
It's still
on.
It's still on.
Let me tell you something. You know, I've been around a long time, and I just can't understand. It's all right. I'll pull another wire. Get out of here.
Ladies and gentlemen, there's nothing wrong with your TV set. It's just that Mr. Rizzo finally broke our equipment. Last Friday, I asked Police Commissioner Morton...
The police misconduct continued well into the 1980s. Marissa Bluestein of the Pennsylvania Innocence Project said the detective division was notorious for its cruelty.
The tactics by the police department out on the street were echoed in the investigation rooms. As Marshall was saying, we have many cases from that era where individuals... you know, say, and has been backed up, that they were beaten by police officers in the interrogation rooms, or they were threatened with death, or they withheld food, or they withheld water. They kept them awake. Any detective who has been on the force for any time will tell you very famous, frankly, method for the detectives was to take a telephone book, put it on somebody's head, and then hit them through the telephone book using a billy club, which causes tremendous pain, but leaves no mark. And so they knew that what they were doing was outside the law, but they did it anyway. And that is certainly not every officer. I don't mean to speak for every officer, but there was no doubt a core group of officers at the time who relied on brute force to be able to try to, quote, solve crimes.
Detectives showed many photos to the victim. Marshall Hale's image was among them because of a prior arrest.
From the information we have, was from photos or slides, excuse me, that were being shown on a wall at the police administration building. And by all accounts, she went through 100 or so pictures. When Marshall's photo came up, and like Marshall said, it was an older photo when it came up, she said something along the lines of, that looks like him. So there was a detective who was with her at the time who was witnessing it. And after each slide was shown, she would make a note on the paper. Well, the paper said, could have a check for identification, no identification, or blank, and that was, neither box was checked for that. And what she wrote in was possible identification. From there, they went to the victim's house a few days later with a photo array, and all we know is that it was the same picture of Marshall that was a tentative identification from the time with the police administration building, and she may or may not have been told the same picture was there. It's not quite clear from the testimony.
Detectives brought Marshall Hale in for questioning.
I was scared to death. I thought they was going to kill me. It was crazy because they were trying to actually literally make me, you know, he said it was me, right? Honestly, because they knew it wasn't me, but at no time did I ever say, nah, it was me. I didn't, you know, even the confession, well, not confession, but the statements that I gave them, right, wasn't criminating. I just told them it wasn't me, and I ain't do nothing, you know what I mean? I knew to keep my, you know what I mean, to keep, you know what I'm saying, that I ain't do nothing because I definitely wasn't trying to, you know what I mean, incriminate myself and get caught up on that. So I would rather them go ahead on and actually, you know, do what they was going to do. Like, they kind of put their hands on me, they choked me, you know what I mean?
Despite being handcuffed to a table in an interrogation room and being assaulted by a detective, Marshall Hale said nothing implicating himself. Ultimately, he was charged with rape based solely on the identification made by the victim. When the case went to trial, new evidence came to light.
Essentially mid-trial, the defense lawyer told me that the Commonwealth's attorney, the district attorney, said to him, here's information I need to show you. I think it might be exculpatory. And they reviewed it, and this was reports from the rape kit that had been collected from the victim, as well as some blood which had been on her knee sock and some believed to be blood that was left behind. First of all, you have to understand where this attack took place was in what we in Philadelphia call at least a shooting gallery, right, where people would go at the time to use drugs, very often with needles. And so it was a very unpleasant place. There, usually in these areas, there's blood around already in the area. So it's, in my opinion, quite likely that there was already some blood evidence around the scene that was unrelated to the actual rape, and that, you know, may have gotten on our clothes and contaminated our clothing. But the rape kit came back, and the results were that the victim is type O and a secretor, that, you know, Marshall is type A, right? Marshall, you're A. Let's get confused, you're A or B. Marshall's type A, and the results indicated the presence of B. That's what the evidence was. And that's what presented to the trial. And it went in a very, quite frankly, kind of confusing and haphazard way. I think that no one was expecting to have that evidence come in. So neither the prosecutor nor the defense counsel really did a very good job about explaining everything.
Essentially, the test showed that Marshall could not possibly have been the attacker. But the defense attorney did not understand the test results, and it's unclear whether the prosecutor did either.
Now remember, you know, Marshall was tried in the early 90s. Right? This is before the DNA exonerations. This is before juries really had an understanding that an eyewitness could get up on the stand, particularly an eyewitness who had been so traumatically attacked, and look at a defendant and definitively say, that's the man, but be completely wrong. Right? So that kind of phenomenon wasn't really present at the time. It was still very much about, you know, our criminal justice system doesn't make errors. We convict the right people. And we really didn't have this now cultural shift understanding of how people can get wrongly convicted. And the jury, given that evidence, given the strength of a young girl who takes a stand and looks at Marshall and says, that's the guy, even though her initial description was off on every level, she described a man who was about 5'11", Marshall's about 5'7", 5'8", a man who was light-skinned African-American, Marshall is dark-skinned, a man who was about 200 or so pounds, Marshall at the time I think was 140, a man who was in his 30s, Marshall was in his early 20s. Right? I mean, on every indicator it was off. But nonetheless, the jury took that information and still came back with a conviction.
Prison is always frightening, but it is particularly scary for an innocent person.
You know, I believe in God, I stand strong, and I believe in people. I haven't given up on people. You know, I don't feel no bitterness in my heart. I don't have no animosity, you know what I mean? And I really don't feel nothing against anybody. So, you know what I mean? That's really one of the positive aspects that really kept me strong while I was in prison, that I really didn't walk around with guilt. You know what I mean? That guilt, because there's a lot of people that's walking around with guilt for stuff they did, and it just eats them up inside, you know what I mean? And I didn't have that, you know what I mean? When I was walking around, people was like, you know, the guys that did believe in me, they're like, man, how you do that, man? I'd be mad as hell if I was you, man. I'd be like, man, hating and stuff like that, right? And I said, no, I couldn't do that, you see what I'm saying? And that's what kept me young, you know, kept my health, you know what I mean? Kept me strong, you know what I mean? In fact, I pray for people, you know what I mean? I pray for her and her family and, you know what I mean, things of that nature. So, you know what I mean? That's what I would like, you know, to say, you know, believe in God, you know, keep the faith, you know what I mean? Never give up.
During the more than 3 decades Marshall served in prison, he wrote letters to more than 150 innocence organizations asking them to consider his case. He was one of the first cases taken up by the Pennsylvania Innocence Project.
The reason that nobody had pursued the case was because the city had either lost or destroyed the physical evidence, so it could not be submitted for DNA testing. But it seemed that no one had an expert review the lab reports which Marshall had gotten through litigation in federal court. So that's one of the first things I did, was we contacted the head of the Forensic Science Department at Arcadia University and asked him to review the materials for us. And you know, when he did, and he concluded, as everybody else had who reviewed it, that Marshall was innocent, he actually was able to walk us through the various tests that had been done and the timing that they had been done. And it turns out that while Marshall is indeed type A, the jury didn't know that he is also a secretor, which just means that like 80% of the population, if you're a secretor, all of your bodily materials contain your ABO blood type. So your saliva, you know, your tears, everything. And of course, that would include semen left behind at a rape kit. But the trick was that information was never told to the jury. And that information was withheld by the government all that time.
And when you say it was withheld, was it deliberately withheld? Like, we got some stuff here that might exonerate him? Or was it like, we don't understand this and we're just not going to share it?
It's almost impossible to know at this point. Our position is and always will be that any information they had should have been turned over while the case was going on, and the case was still going on. And nobody from the lab called the DA's office to say, hey, we did some more testing, here's what you should know. Nobody from the DA's office, from what we can tell, called the lab to say, hey, is there anything else we need to know? So that last piece was never given over. And yet the trial was still going on. It wasn't over. So it's kind of unfathomable to me that there would be additional testing going on. They don't reach back and say, yeah, we've completed our testing. These are the final results, regardless of the stage of the trial. So when we learned that from the excerpt from Arcadia, that became the basis for the petitions that we filed on Marshall's behalf.
On July 13, 2017, he walked away from a Pennsylvania prison a free man. It was the culmination of years of legal motions.
I was saying to myself, this is the time, you know, this is what I've been waiting on for 33 years, you know what I mean? To start hearing yes, because I'm hearing no, deny, no, deny, no, deny, turn down, oh man. You know, for 33 years, you know, but I never gave up, you know what I mean? And I praise God for that. You know, I never gave up, man. It's bad because there's guys in there that's given up, man. They literally just given up. So that kept me like saying, man, I'm gonna just keep the faith and I'm gonna keep believing.
Folks, I don't know about you, but I'm always looking for something healthy to eat. And the problem is, I don't always eat healthy. If it was left up to me, I'd be sitting in front of the TV eating corn chips. And that's because I don't plan very well. And it's an effort to go out and to store and hunt down healthy things to eat. But hey, you can get healthy things delivered to your home to dine on. And these aren't meals. These are just snacks, healthy snack food. What a concept. The company I'm talking about is Hungry Root. They were founded back in 2015. Hungry Root is a brand of healthy comfort food. They take foods that people associate with indulgence and lack of health and reinvent them using vegetables and other wholesome ingredients. And they'll deliver them to your house every week. Think of them as the healthy convenience food company. They deliver weekly boxes of foods that customers can use to make a variety of inspiring, delicious dishes. All their food is plant-based and gluten-free. Their meals come either ready to eat or ready in less than 10 minutes. Customers can choose to make the dishes according to the recipes that are provided or mix and match ingredients for additional flexibility. They offer over 75 dishes that customers can make at home, like sweet potato pad thai made from sweet potato noodles, spicy peanut sauce, and snap peas. I'm just saying, that is just absolutely delicious. And then there's the almond chip pea cookie dough. I can't wait to serve this up for my three daughters. They love ice cream. And the idea that I could fool them and get them to eat something healthy that they're also going to think is indulgent, I just think is so awesome. And you can even eat it straight from the container, folks. There are no commitments to working with Hungry Root. You can skip a weekly box when you don't need it. And folks, there are just so many people out there that love it. It's gotten a 4.6 Facebook rating. You can't do much better than that. It is just exceptionally popular. And guess what? Because you're listening to Suspect Convictions, you can save $25 off on your first two orders, a $50 saving, by using the code SUSPECT at checkout. To get started, go to HungryRoot.com. That's $25 each of the first two orders using SUSPECT at checkout. Once again, folks, go to HungryRoot.com and enter the code SUSPECT to get $25 off on your first two orders. I'm just saying, go for it. You're going to enjoy this food. It's really good. This is Scott Reeder, founder of Suspect Convictions. I'm joined today by Michelle Ben-Simon, who's our narrator and also a true crime buff.
A lot of people don't realize this, but I mean, you know, these innocence projects, they get hundreds of applications from inmates every year. Each one of them does. And, you know, they only can take on a handful of cases because most of them are, you know, small nonprofits with maybe one or two staff attorneys, and that's it. And so it's only like they can take on 100 cases a year or anything like that. And so it's very disheartening for them to turn away so many people. And you just kind of wonder how many people are out there that, you know, this guy got turned down by about 150 innocence projects before somebody was willing to take it. I mean, and that's kind of sad because it came out that he was absolutely positively innocent. I mean, factually innocent. I mean, it was like it would be a biological impossibility for him to have done this.
It's just mind-blowing to me that what I was reading was that people were confused by this evidence. That's kind of what I don't understand. I mean, it's kind of point blank what his blood type is. It just seems like I don't know what was so confusing.
I don't know what was also confusing either. Even me with high school biology class, I think I could have figured that one out. Gosh, this isn't the person that could have done this. It's biologically impossible for somebody with this blood type to have sexually assaulted this young girl. I mean, but it also kind of points, I mean, I hate to say this, but it kind of points to the scientific illiteracy among a lot of people, including lawyers. I mean, it's like, they really don't understand, you know, even some of the more basic things is about science sometimes. And they just didn't understand what they were looking at. That this was not just something that could help the defendant. This is something that would fully exonerate him. And neither the defense or the prosecution apparently understood that.
Yeah, it just seems crazy to me, really. It just seems like it's biological, it's scientific, it's right there, and it still gets ignored. Like, we go through a lot of cases, and I think, you know, there's times where the evidence is, you know, like in the last case where they managed to prove through a base of scurvy, which that even seemed very far-fetched. So sometimes we see these things that are far-fetched, but they still exonerate some of these prisoners. But in this case, it's like full. There's no question. There's no, it's literally in the science and in the biology.
The other thing that ran through my mind is it just sounds like the Philadelphia Police Department was just absolutely running wild at that time. I mean, you know, they were beating people in interrogation rooms with the phone books and billy clubs. Heck, the mayor was attacking reporters out on the street, literally. I mean, Matthew, he told me, I didn't have this in the tape, but he said that, you know, he'd gotten beaten on the street by police officers the same way Rodney King was during the LA riots. And it's like, wow. I mean, I just don't get that. I mean, these are the people we have out there that work are supposed to be working for us and serving our community, and they're acting like bullies.
Yeah, that corruption is real. Like, that physical damage that they're causing on their own communities is more damaging, you know, on everybody's mental health, on sort of the community feeling. I can imagine it being very, very difficult to live in a space of complete brutality.
Yeah, I mean, especially if you're a minority. I mean, you know, if you're one of those African-American families that moved to Philadelphia during the 60s and 70s, and, you know, the demographics of Philadelphia is changing from being a white working class community to being a more of a predominantly African-American community. And yet you have these thugs in uniform going after minority groups. I mean, it's just insane to me. So what else stood out to you on this case?
I guess, again, something that we've seen is kind of sitting with the victim and going through and kind of picking apart anyone that they think could fit this description. And it seemed like her description was completely off from Marshall. So that was also very confusing for me.
What ran through my mind is, okay, she gives this description of the guy, and they're showing her photos of people that don't fit that description.
Exactly.
Why? And you can't help but wonder. I mean, during the first interview of this woman, or this girl, I should say, she's only 14, she said, well, he kind of looks like him. But it was not, this is him or anything like that. Then they go to her house again with photos, and they come out saying it was a positive ID. Like, if you looked at him the first time and you didn't think it was him, or you thought it was might look a little bit like him, and then how the second time around do you come to the conclusion that is him for sure? I mean, what's changed?
I mean, you have to wonder what they said to her.
I have to wonder that too. I mean, I just think,
yeah,
they were like, you sure it's not this guy?
Exactly.
You know, we think it might be this guy.
And it's, again, it's giving these victims kind of the hope that this person could be caught. And it's putting in their minds that there will be this retribution. There will be this feeling of relief once this person has been put away and this person can't hurt anybody else ever again. And it's a mind game. And it seems like they're convincing these people that these are the right people. And it just seems like a way for them, for the police, to get their way.
Well, you also wonder about, like, that 14-year-old girl, she's now in her 40s. And, you know, what would go through your mind if you read in the newspaper that this guy had been fully exonerated, that the DNA or the blood test showed that it couldn't have possibly been him, and he went to prison solely on your ID? I mean, wouldn't you be overwhelmed with guilt?
Absolutely.
And you've already been victimized once, I mean, by, you know, by a horrible person who did this in the first place.
And do you think that over time you ever lose that kind of clarity of where you were at in that moment? Like, do you think she thinks back now and thinks, how could I have ever identified this person as this when it was so clearly wrong? Or do you think that she more so has felt this entire time like there's no way that it could have been wrong?
I think she may have been persuaded into that thinking in that way. I mean, I don't know. But I know that having covered a lot of these cases over the years, I think the one person said that she made a comment when he was in court. I thought he was taller than that. And I thought that he was even seeing him physically in the physical presence. And then she said, I guess during the cross-examination, she said, well, the prosecutor said to expect the man who did this to be in the courtroom for me to identify. Well, he was the only African-American in the courtroom. And it's kind of like, well, aren't you kind of setting it up for her to identify the only African-American in the courtroom? I mean, it's just, the whole thing just really doesn't smell right. But I can't help but feel really badly for that child. I mean, A, she got sexually assaulted in a horrible way. B, she ID'd a man wrongly. I mean, she made a mistake and ID'd the wrong person and ended up going to prison for 33 years. And C, the person who did this is still out there and has probably harmed other people.
And then she feels responsible for that in some way, for sure. Which she shouldn't, but I don't think she should feel responsible for not. It's a fine line. I know we talk about this a lot as to, like, if it's on the victim at all. And I feel like at 14, I don't think that there's anything for her to feel sorry for, because when you're sitting around in a room full of authority figures kind of telling you and guiding you and telling you how to feel and what to do, I can't imagine having the strength or just feeling like you could do any of that properly.
Not to mention, you've been through the most traumatic thing that's ever happened to you in your life at that point. I mean, a man's taking you at gunpoint into a abandoned building where junkies chewed up and sexually assaulted you. The young woman who was sexually assaulted was Hispanic. The person who sexually assaulted her was African American. IDs are notoriously bad at picking as far as wrongful convictions, but they're even worse when they're cross-racial. I mean, recognizing somebody of a different race is even, the error rate even goes up further. And, you know, I can't imagine, you know, if you're in that kind of emotional state that you're likely to be in, how reliable you're going to be. I mean, it's not fair, but it raises really reasonable questions. I mean, and how much pressure was she put under by the police to identify one particular person? I don't know.
And this is where evidence just has to come into play a lot more than it is, because you can't expect a victim who's just been through, like you said, the most traumatic experience of their life to be able to be the sole identification on someone's conviction. It has to come down to evidence. And if you don't understand the evidence, then you figure out how to understand it and read it, because it just seems like in this system where a lot of times when people are wrongly convicted, it seems like it was solely based on a wrongful choice by the victim who was pressured in some way, or we don't fully know, but we only assume. And it seems like evidence should have more of a play than ever.
I agree. I'm going to ask you this question. Do you think she owes him an apology? She made a mistake that resulted in him spending 33 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit. Does she owe him an apology?
I think maybe it would make her feel better and maybe make him feel better, but I don't think she owes it to him because she was so young. I don't know. It's tough. What do you think?
You know, I go back and forth on that. I mean, she made it. I don't think anybody's inferring that she did something malicious, but she did make a mistake that resulted in horrible consequences for someone. I don't know. I mean, I guess I would lean towards, yeah, she should. I don't think she's obligated to do it, but I think it would help with the healing for both people to say I'm sorry.
Exactly. I agree.
I mean, I just, you know, I can't imagine. I mean, it just seems unreal to me that a child had to go through that. And you just wonder how many more people were victimized by whoever did that was never arrested. You know, I don't know. But I can tell you this. Somebody who does something like that with a gun and dragging a stranger off the street, it wasn't their first time and it probably wasn't their last time.